For the speakers today, Andreas, Shay, and Michael. If you have a question, just go ahead and raise your hand. So I see that Leo was the first one. So let him go first.
Hey guys. So this is a question for Michael. Yes, it's related to what you already sort of confessed that you don't have a strong argument, but I kind of want to push on that question a little bit more. So it seems like in the confining phase, when F's are confined, you know, it's plausible that, you know, it's very likely that you are, you know, the Hilbert space is close to the spin. But it seems like in the deconfined phase where the fermions are, you know, just see some Coulomb electromagnetic field and are, you know, they're fairly freely hopping around. You have all these components to the many-body wave function, to the fermionic wave function, which are need to be projected out. Is the only thing one can is that it's still somehow in the same phase?
Say that again, the last part. The only thing what?
In the deconfining phase, fermions are basically just freely hopping around, much like our ordinary electrons in the presence of a Coulomb field with not much penalty. So that means the fermionic wave function, gauge invariant wave function of the fermions and the gauge field is basically just free fermions. So that means there are many components of that psi zero that has double occupancy and zero occupancy components. So it just seems implausible that that's has anything to do with the spin wave function.
Okay, yeah, so I think I'll say, if I have time, I was gonna say a little bit about this next time, but I think the question one really needs to ask, if you get down to it, is obviously that's not in the spin wave function. Okay, so there's two questions. The sharp question is the effective theory we write down correct? What does it mean to be correct? Is it an effective theory that could be realized by some Hamiltonian, some spin Hamiltonian Absolutely. Out there? I think what I was going to say next time is the wave function itself, psi spin, is not on a very firm footing. So the thing we would really hope to be put on a firm footing is just the effective theory. We'd like to say the effective theory is physical. So now, even that, I'm not sure how to make a very precise argument for, but to prove the effective theory is physical, it sort of, in some sense, it's a question about anomalies. Like, because, you know, if the anomalies are the same, if you have a field theory and a Hilbert space which kind of share the same anomalies, you generally expect you can realize that field theory in that Hilbert space. So kind of the question we want to know is, does this gauge theory kind of capture all the right, I don't know, anomalies, the right structure of the spin models, it's such that it can be embedded in the spin Hilbert space in some way. And
so
then
what
the argument
what anomalies yeah. you have in mind, like so.
Well, so that one way you could think about it in terms of anomalies is that sometimes people think of having the spin 1/2 per unit site, like that model of just a spin 1/2 is kind of anomalous in the sense that you can't write down a gap state that's translationally mm-hmm. invariant, you know, non-degenerate, right? And so people think of that as actually living on the boundary of like an SPT phase with, it's like a weak SPT phase or something.
Okay.
And so you can kind of think of it roughly as carrying some anomaly associated with having an odd number of spin 1/2 per unit cell. So one thing you certainly want is that the gauge theory you write down can live on the same bound, the same is a physical theory that lives on the same bound, the boundary of the same SPT phase as the original spin model. And that background gauge charge is crucial to making that work, to make it have kind of, but I don't have a very sharp argument for why it, or even how to quite make precise this idea of anomaly matching. But I think that's, to me, that's the way to go if you want to try to put it on a firm footing.
Thank you.
Next, we have a question from Darshil Doshi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
I have a question for Michael. It's boring, silly, but it's about the very last equation in your presentation. If I remember correctly, it was the statement for Gauss's law or the gauge invariance constraint. And it has it had divergence of E on one side and f dagger f minus 1 on the other side. So for each spin, the constraint we have is that on each side we have exactly one fermion, which means that f dagger f equals 1, which gives us divergence of E0. So does this mean that each spin theory is just a source-free version of the original gauge theory? And is that true, and is it a useful observation?
So I think what's true is that spin Hilbert space, you can embed it in the big gauge theory Hilbert space. If you try to embed it in there, it corresponds to, like you said, states where divergence of E equals 0. So it's the subspace of states which have divergence of E equals 0, or equivalently have one fermion on each site. And then what do you want to do with that? Well, the question you want to ask is, you have your full gauge theory Hamiltonian, and it has some ground state that lives within this big Hilbert space. What you'd like to ask is, to be really precise, is whether there exists some local unitary transformation which can kind of, even though it doesn't sit in the spin Hilbert space, you'd like to ask, is there a local unitary transformation that can put it in the spin Hilbert space? That is, does there exist some local unitary transformation that arranges things so that divergence of E equals 0? And then you could embed your theory, your ground state, into the spin Hilbert space, and you could embed your Hamiltonian into the spin Hamiltonian space. So that's kind of the question at some level, is whether there's a way to find some unitary transformation that forces divergence of E to be 0 for all the low energy states. That's the question. And I don't know if a sharp answer for that, but whether such unitary transformation exists is probably related to something about anomalies. Whether the theories have the right anomalies determines whether you can embed one theory in the other, whether that unitary transformation exists.
I see. Thank you.
Next, we have a question from John McGreevy.
Okay, hi. So Michael, I guess I have two things to say. One is very closely related to the previous comment, which is, so we can, adding a div E squared term to the Hamiltonian of Maxwell theory seems like it doesn't do much damage to the Coulomb phase. Like it's an irrelevant operator. So maybe that's a good way to think about why that can give a good, description of the spin state. I guess it's related to the complaint that Leo was making.
Oh, I see. What you're looking for, and this is what I'm looking for too. So if this comes out of this session, this is great. But you're looking for like some sharp argument for why the spin, basically why the effective theory is physical. And you want to say, oh, I can turn on this div E squared term and somehow, I don't know, adiabatically move into the spin Hilbert space or something. Is that what you're
Yeah, that's the idea. Yeah.
Maybe I haven't.
I mean, I guess if you make the coefficient infinite, maybe I don't know how to show that that doesn't destroy the phase, but certainly with an order one coefficient, you know, or I guess order one over some large scale, it doesn't do too much damage.
Yeah, if you could find some perturbation that you can turn on and kind of, that's what we're looking for, that kind of adiabatically takes you, that is a local unitary transformation that takes you from your original state to a state that lives in that div E equals 0 subspace, that would be amazing. That'd be great. So if turning that on does that, that would be great.
Just the fact that it's an irrelevant perturbation of the Maxwell theory with charge, of QED, right? Like it comes with some coefficient, which is 1 over an energy scale squared. I think that goes in the right direction. So then the other thing I wanted to ask was, it's related to a question asked by Gautam Nambiar during the Q&A, which is, we often use this projected free fermion wave function as like a variational ansatz, a variational state. Is it possible to make a better variational state, which includes the gauge fluctuations, by projecting the gauge theory ground state, do you think? Is it actually possible to project the gauge theory Hilbert space into the spin?
I don't know the answer to that. Maybe someone else here does know. I think that it seems like something like that seems reasonable, but I actually don't know the answer whether there is a construction like that. That's a great idea. I don't know exactly how to make that work, but probably it may exist. if someone else knows the answer, please email or speak.
Thanks.
Rajan Ma, you can go ahead.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, I have a question for Michael Lewin. I'm very confused. So we need to require H to be much smaller than K here on notation so that the gauge field is not confined, right? And
yes,
is this statement correct?
That's right. We want to. That's the effective theory that the slave fermion construction postulates. It says that's a physical theory, and that this wave function, in fact, describes it. Yes.
And meanwhile, we need to have the fermion hoping T to be much larger than H in order for the fermion to be weakly coupled to the gauge field. Is that correct?
Yes. We want H to be the smallest scale. That's right.
But my question is, why do we need to have T to be much smaller than K?
Yeah, that may not be essential, but you're saying because the two terms kind of commute. Yeah, I think, it may not be essential to require that, but I guess I just like thinking of it that way. You turn on K first, that makes the fluctuations very small, then you turn on the hopping, and then last you turn on some small gauge fluctuations. Yeah, I don't know if we actually need it. If your original ansatz is already kind of the lowest energy state, sort of the lowest energy mean field ansatz, then mm-hmm. then that probably doesn't matter because the T term itself will generate some kind of energy for fluxes, right? I think as long as that energy, what we don't want is that the hopping to favor some other flux configuration distinct from sort of the zero flux configuration in this language. But I guess if you've already chosen your ansatz to somehow be the lowest energy, then that won't be a problem maybe. It may not be necessary. I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you.
I saw a question from Meng Cheng. There we go. Go ahead.
Hey, Michael. So I think everyone's kept asking about this, but I just want to clarify again. So you're saying that the gauge invariant Hilbert space of the gauge theory for the parton construction is larger than, still larger than the original spin state, spin Hilbert space.
That's right. If you have multi sites, I think maybe one thing I could have said is if you have just a single site, sure, which is kind of trivial, and right, kind of the electric field is zero in some sense, then it reduces. So for a single site, the gauge theory is the same as the original spin model. But for more than one site, which is of course what we're interested in, it's right, not, it's a larger Hilbert space, yeah, than the original.
Then if that's the case, then no, if I think about, say, some excited states in this gauge invariant subspace, some charged states emitting field lines, is that outside the spin Hilbert space, if I take this literally?
So all of those states in the gauge invariant, you know, all the states in our effective theory, so the effective theory is not, the Hilbert space of the effective theory is bigger than the spin Hilbert space. And that means that even the low energy states in the effective theory are not going to live in the spin Hilbert space. Okay. Mm-hmm. They don't live in the spin Hilbert space. The claim of the kind of slave fermion construction is that there's some unitary map. There's some way to embed those states in the spin Hilbert space. So everyone, although they're not, as written, they don't really live in the spin-Hilbert space, they have a corresponding state. There's a corresponding state that does live in the spin-Hilbert space, okay? And roughly speaking, that corresponding state can be obtained by projection. However, projection is not a unitary map. So it's not, projection's kind of a crude approximation to what you really want to do, which is somehow unitarily put it in that space. But that's the claim, is that each of those low energy states, there's a corresponding state in the spin Hilbert space. Okay. That's the claim.
But that part is not really, like, we don't really have a controlled way to show that, at least.
Well, that's what everyone's asking. And I'd like to understand that better. And there are various arguments for why. So I didn't say this, but there's large N, There's all these various ways to derive this approach, and in certain limits you can kind of show that such a thing might exist or so on. But if you really want to show it for spin one half, then I think it comes down to some question about anomalies, but I don't know how to quite make it precise.
Okay, thank you.
So there's another question for Michael in the chat. Maybe Michael, you can just read it directly. Take some time to process it.
Where can I find it?
In the Q&A? Yeah.
Ah, I see.
But in the meantime, I'd like to revive a question for Shade Chen, I think from John McGreevy, about, I think basically, is there a systematic way to find the string operator in the double semion model?
Well, I learned that from Michael's paper. So this this double semion model is part of this string net construction, and you can think of the way to write down either the wave function or the Hamiltonian term as fusing some strings into a lattice, and that also gives you the string operator if you take an open string or a closed string on a bigger loop. So there are some diagrammatic rules which allows you to systematically write down these string operators in string net models, which is in Michael's paper. Does that answer your question, Joe?
Yeah, I guess that's the kind of thing one hopes for. Maybe the question I really wanted to ask is there is a way to do it without being Michael? Yeah, I guess that's too much to hope for. Thanks.
Let's see. Yes, just as a reminder to the participants, feel free to just raise your hand. Michael, do you want to address this question in the Q&A or?
I guess I'm not sure I can address it. So the question is whether the gauge flux can or cannot be written in terms of spins.
So yeah, Gautam has his hand raised, so I'll just allow him to directly ask it.
Oh yeah, sorry. I was just following on a question that I saw in the discussion. It was about whether the magnetic flux through a placket can be written in terms of the spin. So I guess the conclusion in the discussion was that that only the product of fermion hopping along the placket can be written in terms of the spins, but not the magnetic flux itself. But I was under the impression that like they are just conjugates of one another, so they should have exactly the same correlation functions apart from contact terms, maybe.
So what do you mean by when you say magnetic flux? Oh. Are you thinking of the operator in the dynamical in the gauge theory?
Like right.
So I think the claim, I don't know if this is answering the question, probably not. I don't know an explicit, okay. I'm not sure there's a kind of explicit representation of that flux operator in terms of spin operators that you can write down. But the claim of the slave particle approach is that such an operator should exist. In other words, because the whole effective theory is, if you believe the effective theory, then all the operators in the effective theory have some corresponding partners in the spin model, at least at low energy. So there should be some operator that correctly measures the flux, at least for the low energy states. But what that operator looks like, I don't know.
Okay.
But I don't know if you're asking for something more microscopic. I mean, next time we'll talk a little bit about how to visualize the gauge fields in a microscopic way, but I don't know if it'll fully, I don't know, we can repeat the question then, but I don't know if it'll fully answer your question about the flux operator per se. Okay.
Thanks, I'll wait for the next talk. Thanks.
Hey Tim, let me add a more comment to John's question. So if we are not Michael, if we don't know the string net picture of this topological model, So because we got this model from gauging something, so of course they reflect the way that symmetry defect acts in these models with symmetry. So in principle, you can make a symmetry defect, flip the signs of Hamiltonian along the way and see how the ground state changes and try to find the unitary operator that implement the changes along the defect. And then if you somehow turn that into a gauge invariant way, I think that will become the string operator in the gauge model. I suppose you, maybe John already know that, but I just want to add this point. This is a more generic way, of course, it's not saying it's easy to do.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, that's a nice point of view, but it can be quite hard to figure out how to decorate the end of it there.
Okay, Rehua, San, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I have a question for Xie, about. I want to ask, what is the rule of games when we talk about what are the possible phases out of gauging an SPT, And what would we expect, what type of anions we can get? Like, for example, for the transfer field IC model, I can expect we basically get a pi flux and Z2 charge, and they have this type of Brillouin statistics. But for the double semion, why we expect to get that type of anionic excitation, and what is the rough game for general construction, general cases? That's my question.
Yeah, great question. And so just like you said, if you have a, let's stick with these three symmetry groups so that everything's gapped. And then you would expect gauge charge, which is, which descends from whatever you have in the original system. Whether if you have a bosonic charge, you have a, this is a bosonic quasi-particle. If you have a fermionic charge, it's a fermionic quasi-particle. And that's it, right? That's all the possibilities. Then you have the AB effect, which is even for non-abelian group, you can wind around the charge around the symmetry flux. So the charge will be labeled by irreducible representations of the gauge group, and the flux will be labeled by the conjugacy class of the gauge group, and they can wind around each other like how a conjugacy class acts on the charges, acts on the irreducible representations. And apart from that, the only thing that can tell us what kind of order we have in the original system is what is the flux doing among themselves. So in this case, we have only one non-trivial flux, so it's just the self-statistics of the flux. And if you have a fermionic system, the flux can be non-abelian. Like if you have a superconductor, a chiral superconductor, and you gauge it, and you might get the Majorana zero mode for your pi flux. But there are some consistency conditions that these pi fluxes have to satisfy. Basically, it's a pi flux, so if you have two copies of them, you need to get back to either vacuum or charge. And from there, you can basically derive all the possibilities. I think Michael has a very nice paper on that. And so if you do, if you stay in two plus one dimension, then you think about pi flux, then either it's bosonic or it's semionic, because two copies of this pi flux needs to be trivial, right? Meaning the self-statistics have to be bosonic. So that exhausts everything. And then if you go to the fermion case, you have more possibilities. Even when you merge two pi flux and it becomes non-abelian and pops out a vacuum plus the fermion. So that gives you the 16-fold way of an XA. And you can do that more generally and even in higher dimensions.
For this double semion case, actually, I get this intuition like from answering Q&A session from Meng Cheng. And like in the double semion, a pi flux can be imagined to have a half of a Z2 charge so that we exchange them, we'll get a I factor of I. And does that imply like a two pi flux in this model carries one Z2 charge so that it's not a local operator because it's not gauge invariant?
So saying that, that you can think of the self-statistics of the pi flux as coming from attaching half charge to a bosonic flux, and but then you fuse two pi flux, you get something with one charge, right? And then when attaching one charge is an integer charge is something that's okay. It's just can think of it as attaching a composite of quasi particles. So if you're in a transaction theory, it actually works. Let me not go there. But I guess I don't exactly understand why you say having an integer charge is a problem.
Because you can
attach another integer charge to cancel it.
Oh, I see. I understand. Because I thought like a 2-pi flux should be a gauge invariant object. Maybe that's wrong.
Well, you can combine a 2-pi flux with a gauge charge. That gives you a composite object, which, yeah.
But I think 2-pi fluxes don't give you a gauge charge. Like that's something about that picture is incorrect, right? Like 2-pi fluxes give you something trivial in this theory.
It's bosonic. It doesn't give you a minus one statistic. So it's a bit tricky to say this. It's hard to exactly pinpoint this half charge statement for the Z2 case. I think it's better stated if you have a transcendent theory of that type. But pictorically, yeah, people say that.
Okay, yeah, thanks.
Andreas, there's a history question from Hao Gang. Could you say something about the history about cyber duality, motivations, how he found that it works, etc.?
I saw that question, but I know cyber duality was invented before I was a graduate student, so I don't really know what the history is. I try to convey how people checked it. These days, there are easy ways we can understand it using brain constructions, but there's one way of coming up with this is you're just really smart, and I think that's how they came up with this. There was Cyberg, Witten came before Cyberg alone. There's a long history of people looking at dualities, but you should ask Nadi how he came up with this. I don't think he's here, but he assume we will be back.
Okay, thanks. We're almost out of time. Maybe take a one or two more. Christian Chang.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I have two questions for either or both Xie and Michael. So first question is about the minimal coupling to the gauge field. So when we gauge a theory, what principle can we really say says that we should couple minimally to the gauge field? And when we introduce, for example, like the kinetic term for the gauge field, the flux term, which is like the plaquette, like why use a minimal plaquette? Why not use, say, a Wilson loop around two plaquettes or something like that, right? And then my second question is about like what about like frustrated models where you have like spin degrees of freedom living on the bonds of a lattice already? In that case, it seems like the construction is a little different. The spin degrees of freedom act more like the fluxes themselves than as matter. So I'm thinking, for example, a Kagome lattice, anti-ferromagnet is frustrated, and the spins can be thought of as living on the bonds of a honeycomb lattice. So anyway, yeah.
I think you were, I saw your message in Slack, and for the plaquette term, if you put it on let's say two plaquettes together, we're losing information, right? It's like, so fundamentally what we're trying to describe is that magnetic field is zero everywhere. But if you put two forecasts together, it's saying that the sum of the two is zero. So you're not capturing all the information, and the result is that we end up with some degeneracy due to the... so it's like an icing term to the spins that gives you ground state degeneracy. So... yeah, if Michael wants to ask.
Well, also just in the context of the parton stuff that I was talking about, I think one way to think about that effective Hamiltonian is it's a little bit like Landau-Ginzburg theory. You kind of want to write down all terms that are consistent with, we want to assume we're in this particular limit of weakly fluctuating. But other than that, we kind of want to write down all possible gauge invariant terms because they will be generated. That's at least unless it's finely tuned, right? And so a single plaquette should appear there. You could have two plaquettes, single plaquette, you know, they could all be there in general, but the low energy, you get the same behavior, at least let's say in this U1 gauge theory case, it doesn't matter if I add in a two plaquette term on top of my single plaquette term, you would get the same long wavelength behavior, at least that's the belief. So I think the picture there is all the terms should be there. All gauge invariant terms are there. It should probably be plus dot, dot, dot. And I was just writing down like the minimal number of terms to kind of not be too finely tuned, you know, to get you in the right phase. Okay. But all the terms should be there.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, sorry, I forgot your second question.
So like in, for example, like you have like vertex models or these like ice type models that are said to have emergent gauge symmetries at low energy. So like in that case, usually you have degrees of freedom that are already defined on the bonds rather than the sites, right?
So you can just turn those bonds into sites.
Sorry?
It will be a more complicated lattice where you put...
you could even take like a square lattice and have, you know, you have, but then, yeah, you have spins defined on the bonds.
Yeah.
And then the Hamiltonian of the spin model is usually defined for all, like with all the spins around a vertex, you know, it's like minimal when they sum to some small number or something like that. So like the sum of all the spins is equal to zero. So like the Hamiltonian could be like the sum of all spins around a vertex squared so that that is minimized or something. Like this is like a Kagome antiferromagnet or Pyrochlor antiferromagnet or things like that. But I'm just curious because in that case, the spin degrees of freedom already live on the bonds rather than vertexes. And so it seems like instead of coupling a gauge field to the spins where the gauge field, you know, kind of, well, where the spins act like matter, it's more like, it seems like the construction would have to be different, right? Because the spins themselves act kind of like the gauge field or the gauge flux. And then the matter is like, if I flip a single spin, I create two spin-ons at the ends of a bond. I'm trying to like just generalize some of what has been talked about in the past day or two here. I don't know if any of that necessarily makes sense.
Maybe I can try to see if I can answer your question. So one way to see it is that you can always put all the degrees of freedom on vertex of a different graph of a different lattice. And then the reason we want to put the gauge field on the edges is just because the minimum coupling is along the edges. But of course, you can say, what if I just have toric code as the starting point? And then it depends on the symmetry. You might be thinking about different symmetry, like one-form symmetry or other more complicated symmetries. Is that what you have in mind?
Like, not necessarily. I'm just thinking of like you know, these frustrated magnets, for example, right? They generally, they are constructed from some sort of line graph, usually of a bipartite lattice. So like a Kagome is a line graph of a honeycomb. So you can think of the degrees of freedom as living on the edges of a honeycomb rather than on the vertexes of a Kagome lattice. And so when you construct a gauge theory of these models, then it seems like the construction would have to be a little bit different. And that's what I've been trying to like think about recently. It's a little bit hard to say without writing down. So if it's unclear, then that's okay.
Yeah, I think maybe we should just continue. Let's take at most three more questions. Sorry for going over, but maybe Kyle, Kawakawa.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
So my question is for Xia Chen.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering about, in your construction, when you're gauging these theories, so you've got the torque code and doubled semion, both came from these sort of paramagnet things. So you generalized to three dimensions and you got the X cube model. Is there an analog to the sort of comparison that you did between torque code and doubled semion? So in other words, is there another theory that's, you know, sort of similar to the paramagnet in three dimensions that you get, when you gauge it, you get a theory that has the same sort of types of fractons in terms of like the restriction of their movement, something that would only differ by something that is maybe more subtle, like in two dimensions, it's some topological invariance.
Yeah, exactly. This is a one big topic people call the subsystem symmetry protected topological phase, which are, let's say, 3+1 dimensional models with planar symmetries, but then they're different from just a trivial paramagnet in certain ways. This is very much an ongoing topic. I don't know if Meng is going to touch on that tomorrow, but the situation is that we're basically just starting to construct models that have these kind of property. And one simple example is in 2+1 dimension. In 2+1 dimension, where you have linear symmetries along x and y direction, and it turns out there's a very simple model that people use in quantum information called the cluster state model that has this Z2 subsystem symmetry protected topological order. Although in 2+1 dimension with linear symmetry, if you gauge it, it's like gauging global symmetry in 1+1 dimensional Ising model. It doesn't really give you anything more fractional. So you don't get a fractal model from there. But as what people call SSPT, subsystem symmetry protected topological phase, is a legitimate model. And there are examples in higher dimension as well. But this is very open.
Thank you.
Tarun, Grover, you can go ahead. Tarun, you need
to unmute. Yeah, sorry, yes. So my question was for Michael. Maybe it's kind of not very good question, but when you mentioned earlier that so that's of course true that these the gauge theory and the spin system are really different Hilbert spaces. One is bigger than another. So isn't that and my understanding was a bit like John when he mentioned they are related by some maybe RG. So shouldn't the statement is that there is not a unitary, but perhaps one has to also do some coarse screening in the sense one has to integrate out some stuff to go from one to another. That was maybe part A of the question. And the second part was about this, how to find wave function. If I know wave function of, for example, gauge theory, is there a way to construct wave function for the spin system? I don't know a unique answer, but I was wondering if the following procedure has some meaning, which is that if I can first identify, if it were a CFT, for example, the most natural thing we often do is to identify, so given some operator in the spin system, we ask what is the operator in the gauge theory which has same scaling dimension, the simplest operator. So once we do this identification between A operator in one theory with A operator in the another, in some, maybe that's not, it may have some ambiguity, like, I mean, at least it's not one-to-one, but find the one which is the simplest in some sense. And once you have this mapping, then I'm done, because the density matrix is just given by expectation value of operator times that operator sum over all operators. I was wondering whether, so that gives some well-defined wave function for the spin system in terms of expectation values calculated in the gauge theory. I was wondering, does it have any meaning, or is it just, I don't know. Yeah, these were the two questions.
I see. So your first question is about this RG point of view. for the slave particle or parton constructions. And let's see if I can, if I understand correctly what you're asking, you're saying, you kind of, I think it's similar to Sohn's, maybe what Sohn was trying to was saying, which was that there's this kind of, there's this derivation that's in the literature, derivation maybe in quotes, in the literature for slave fermion or construction, where you take, it's like a path integral construction, where you take a spin model, you write the spins in terms of fermions, you impose a constraint by adding a Lagrange multiplier, you decouple using a Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation, and you do all this stuff, and then you get something that looks like a gauge theory in this path integral formulation, but it's in the strongly confining limit. And then you say, oh, well, it's going to generate, when we integrate out fermions, we're going to generate various terms, and maybe it'll become in the other limit once we integrate out. So I'm familiar with that statement. I think the tricky question is, the subtle question is kind of, I was trying to understand this at the level of Hilbert spaces. So can one make a statement kind of a Hamiltonian formulation about the relationship between the gauge theory that lives in one Hilbert space mm-hmm. and the spin model that lives in the other Hilbert space? I don't know how to connect that question to this RG in the path integral formulation.
Sure. I think my question was your requirement that the embedded smaller Hilbert space wave function be related by a unitary from the bigger one. I was wondering, could it be that's not even true? It's possible that one requires some, when you're coarse graining, that's not a unitary.
I think it has to be unitary. I think it's a unitary embedding. So it's the, I think the coarse grating is like, it doesn't go the other way or something.
That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah.
I understand. Okay. And the second question was about this procedure.
Right. Your second question is about that procedure. Yeah, maybe we can discuss that.
I think I need to detailed.
I'll ask you again about it afterwards. Yeah. I don't quite know how to make this mapping precise. So yeah, if you have ideas, that's great.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, let's just end where we started out with another question from Leo and leave it at that. So Leo, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. So this is a combination of Michael and Shia. So I guess one question I have is it maybe slightly embarrassing. I don't want to say technical question maybe, but I kind of missed the piece of the derivation for the double semion model. So for the conventional paramagnet, when you were gauging it to get the toric code, there was a step where you have the transverse field, and the transverse field on sigma x allows you to set sigma x to 1, and then it becomes a toric code. So then you really just get rid of all the matter field, sigma matter field, and you just get a gauge theory in terms of taus. What exactly is the step that you do? Now you have the phase factors. The transverse field has i's or 1's in front of it for this twisted paramagnet phase. So when you gauge it, like, what do you do with the sigmas? Now you have sigmas running around along with the taus theory. So what do you do?
Michael has it. I learned it from Michael's paper, so Michael can answer how I can
say. Can you just read, summarize maybe what?
Yeah, right. Michael, do you want me to do it?
Yeah, go ahead, yeah.
Okay, so if I remember correctly, so as you said, we indeed can turn this double semion theory into a version where we only have tau, but not sigma. I don't know if it's as generically true, but. At least it's true here that you can always get rid of sigma and retain tau with pretty much the form of the Hamiltonian being the same. And if you ask me how this is done, I think you replace the sigma tau sigma with just one tau, and then replace the plaquette where you have a sigma x in the middle and the tau x around it with just the tau x around it. I think it gives you the same operator algebra. And if you do that kind of
replacement. Is that a choice of a gauge? I mean, like, is it like that you're picking the, what is it called, the axial gauge where sigmas are just one? You kind of absorbing them into taus?
Yeah, you absorb sigma into tau, but not in a way that's just setting sigma x equal to 1, because that that doesn't work.
Right.
So for the transverse field, the toroidal version, it works. But right, in this case, it doesn't. But you can just do this operator replacement. Okay. So yeah, sigma z tau z sigma z becomes just tau z.
Okay.
And sigma x in the middle with a tau z around it, and replace it by tau z around it, tau x around it, sorry. Sigma x in the middle and tau x around it, replace it by just tau x around it without the sigma x in the middle.
But what do you do with the transverse field term, the twisted, you know, with the eyes there?
And that's the sigma z, tau z, sigma z part.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. And I guess, I mean, it's a related question. What is the intuition? I mean, maybe this is a question for Michael. Like, if without thinking about this gauging of the paramagnet, can you give some intuition for constructing this model, this twisted paramagnet model? Like, why is it the I? Why do you want the face to be I as opposed to square root of I, or as opposed to 1 or minus 1, or and why is it just the Nears guys? Like, why is that a good construction? Like, just some guidance of why, what guided
the
intuition?
So that model actually comes from kind of the way we derived that model was we went the opposite way. So we already knew the model for the double semion theory, and we kind of ungauged it. So it turns out there's a general way to so-called ungauged theories. Uh-huh. And that's kind of what we did. We kind of tried to construct a theory that when you gauge it, it gives you that double semion model. That's something you can do generally. And so that's kind of how it, that's one way you can derive it systematically. But then you could say, how do you get the double semion model? And that's from some, you know, some algebraic constraints, you know, string net stuff. There's like some very large class of these models, and you get that model from those, you know, following that construction, and then you ungauge it to get the.
But is there a way to look at the, you know, by looking at the transverse fieldizing, the transverse field, this twisted transverse field model, is there a way to, you know, is there some things you can see in it, just add the level of the global model?
It
has like edge states, or that's an SPT?
Well, it has minus one. The domain walls come with a factor of minus one, right? The wave function is minus one to the number of domain walls. So that's kind of something about that's a kind of non-trivial state somehow. At the level of the spin model, that's the main thing you see, is that the wave function instead is minus one to the number of domain walls. And that's something that you can't get rid of that minus sign with a local unitary, local symmetric unitary.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful.
All right, well, thanks to all the speakers today, and thanks to everyone for participating. We'll see you again at 11 a.m. tomorrow.